Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is March 31st, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Thin Ice, Subgroup Analysis of the Thaws Trial. And our guest skeptic is Professor Daniel Fadovich. He is an emergency physician and clinical researcher based at the Royal Perth Hospital in Western Australia. He is the head of the Center for Clinical Research in Emergency Medicine, Harry Perkins Institute of Medical Research, professor of emergency medicine, University of Western Australia, and director of research for the Royal Perth Hospital. Welcome back to the SGM, Daniel.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be back.
Well, I know you are refreshed and ready to go because you just got back from some holidays.
Yes, we had a recent holiday and it was a wonderful break, and then we're back into it again.
Yeah, the first thing you want to do is come back and talk stroke with me again, right?
Well, like I've said to you before, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, we've become famous in the stroke world since our last podcast. Our names were actually mentioned in a talk about TPA for acute ischemic stroke at the International Stroke Conference 2021.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible that we should gain such notoriety at an international conference. I would label it as a backhanded acknowledgement that there is actually a controversy.
Well, perhaps I should have introduced you as a fellow, quote, non-expert EM contrarian.
I think maybe we should get some t-shirts made with that title, or maybe even start a hashtag with that title.
Oh, don't get me started on social media and new t-shirts. Well, I don't mind being referred to as an EM contrarian. That's fine. But I do wonder, what definition were they using for non-experts?
Well, if you listen to their talk, they had one slide with a big list of all their conflicts of interest. I think their definition of a non-expert EM contrarian is that we don't agree with their views. But as we know from the literature, people who have conflicts of interest end up with a different view and a different interpretation of data to people without conflicts of interest. And in fact, we talk about this in a new piece we've got coming out in ASEP now in April.
Well, here we go again, being skeptical about the stroke literature. Give us a case to start the critical appraisal process.
A 74-year-old man presents to the emergency department after waking up with left-sided weakness. He was last seen well when going to bed at 10 p.m. the night before. He has a history of hypertension and dyslipidemia. His medications include an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor and a statin. His National Institute of Health stroke severity score is 7. The MRI shows an occlusion of the right MCA M2, and his DWI aspect score is 9, and the lesion volume is 3.5 mils.
Well, Daniel, you and I have talked about stroke management a number of times recently. We did SGM number 297 on the reanalysis of ECAS-3 by Brian Alper and his team in 2020. The SGM bottom line from that episode was that the reanalysis of the original ECAS-3 data does not support the potential benefit of TPA given between 3 and 4.5 hours after onset of stroke symptoms and confirms the known potential harm.
Well, as you know, Ken, there have been 13 foundational trials looking at thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke. And of those 13, 11 failed to show benefit on their primary outcome, and 4 were stopped early due to harm or futility. Only 2 clinical trials claimed benefit on their primary outcome. These were ECAS-3 in 2008 and the NINS trial from 1995. Both of these so-called positive studies have been reanalyzed, and on the reanalysis, they question the potential efficacy of TPA while confirming the harm.
And we wrote an article together for the Lown Institute summarizing some of the stroke literature. The question asked was, will it take 50 years or 100 years to get the right answer about TPA for acute ischemic stroke?
One aspect that we did not address was that the newer trials that are using advanced imaging techniques like MRI to extend the window beyond 4.5 hours after the onset of stroke symptoms, papers such as EXTEND in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2019 and ECAS-4 EXTEND. Both of these trials were stopped early, which can introduce additional bias towards efficacy.
The majority of patients included in the two trials extending the time window past 4.5 hours would now qualify for endovascular therapy or EVT clot retrieval. EVT does have more robust evidence for efficacy and safety than systemic thrombolysis.
A systemic review meta-analysis was published by Mistry et al. In Stroke 2017. This included 13 studies, 3 randomized controlled trials, which contributed 25% of all the patients, and 10 observational studies, which contributed 75% of the patients. Good neurologic outcome was defined as a modified Rankin score of 0 to 2. The number needed to treat was 17. However, it was not statistically significant if you just looked at only the higher quality randomized controlled trial data and if you excluded the lower quality observational data.
Yang et al. Published a non-inferiority randomized control trial in the New England Journal of Medicine last year looking at this issue. The primary outcome was a modified Rankin scale score at 90 days and found that EVT alone was not non-inferior to EVT plus TPA. Now, there have been 2 recent RCTs that were published in JAMA investigating the issue, one by Suzuki et al., and it failed to demonstrate non-inferiority. Well, in contrast, Z et al. Found EVT alone was non-inferior to EVT plus TPA. Now, these 2 EVT trials are going to be covered on a future episode of the SJUM in the very near future.
So the trial that we're going to review today is actually a sub-analysis of the THORS, thrombolysis for acute wake-up and unclear onset stroke. So the THORS randomized controlled trial of using low-dose TPA in patients with symptoms on awaking or of an unknown time of onset.
All right, Daniel, give us the clinical question then.
Is MRI-guided thrombolysis at 0.6 milligrams per kilogram beneficial for patients with an unknown stroke onset time?
And what's the reference?
So this is by Toyota et al. MRI-guided thrombolysis, 0.6 milligrams per kilogram, was beneficial for unknown onset stroke above a certain core size. The THORS RCT sub-study from Stroke in 2021. Interestingly, the journal labels it as a clinical trial, even though it's actually a sub-study secondary analysis.
All right, well, let's go through the PICO for this sub-study. What was the population?
So the population was patients with stroke symptoms on awaking or with an unknown time of onset, greater than 4.5 hours since last known well and less than 4.5 hours of symptom recognition. And it was the sub-study of the THORS paper published in 2020, which had 131 patients.
All right, what was the intervention that they used in this study?
So it was intravenous Alteplase 0.6 milligrams per kilo, a 10% bolus followed by a 90% infusion over 60 minutes.
And what did they compare it to?
So they compared it to standard care. so it was not a placebo-controlled trial. And standard care was the use of 1 to 3 antithrombotic drugs, including oral aspirin at 160 to 300 milligrams per day, oral clopidogrel, 75 milligrams per day, intravenous argatroban or intravenous unfractionated heparin, but excluding the combination of argatroban and heparin, according to the decisions of the attending physician. I had to look up what argatroban was because it's not a drug I'm familiar with. It's an anticoagulant that is a small molecule direct thrombin inhibitor. So in this sub-study of 126 people, patients were dichotomized by their ischemic core size or by the National Institutes of Health Stroke Severity Scale.
All right, well, let's talk about the outcomes. What was the primary outcome they were looking in the THAWS sub-study?
So the primary outcome was good neurologic function using a modified Rankin score of 0 to 1 at 90 days.
And they had a number of secondary outcomes, and I'll list those in the show notes. The author's conclusions from the sub-study were, quote, patients developing unknown onset stroke with a DWI aspect 5 to 8 showed favorable outcomes more commonly after low-dose thrombolysis than after standard treatment. End of quote. Now, Daniel, can you remind the SJAMers of the author's conclusions from the original THAWS randomized control trial?
Quote, no difference in favorable outcome was seen between alteplase and control groups among patients with ischemic stroke with unknown time of onset. The safety of alteplase at 0.6 milligrams per kilo was comparable to that of standard treatment. Early study termination precludes any definitive conclusions.
Well, we have mentioned the term aspects, and so we probably should define that term, and it stands for the Alberta Stroke Program Early CT Score, and it is used to determine MCA stroke severity using available CT data.
So to compute aspects, 1 point is subtracted from 10 for any evidence of early ischemic change for each of the defined regions. So if you've got a normal CT, you score 10 points.
So you're 10 out of 10 if you're normal, and then it goes down from there.
Yep.
Now, using the traditional cutoff, less than 8 versus equal to or greater than 8, as a rough estimate for predicting independence may help inform decisions. Aspects suggest that early CT changes in stroke may be a harbinger of poor outcomes. All right, let's get to the quality checklist, though. And we have 11 questions for the checklist for randomized clinical trials. So the first question is, the study population, did it include or focus on those in the emergency department?
Yes.
The patients, were they adequately randomized?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization process?
No. Both patients and investigators were aware of the treatment allocation.
The patients, were they analyzed into the groups which they were randomized?
Yes.
Yeah, so that gets into an intention to treat analysis. The fifth question, the study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
It's unsure from the paper, but I would say probably no. Figure one in the original THAWS paper reports that some patients were not enrolled because it was inconvenient. And if you look at the numbers, they enrolled 131 people over 50 months of 465 that were screened from 40 sites. So they enrolled 28% of the screened patients. And that works out to 2.6 patients per month, or about 1.5 patients per center per year.
Wow, that was some fancy math there. So what you're saying is, each center didn't really enroll a lot of patients. Between 1 and 2 patients per year per center were enrolled in this study. So talk about the limits of the patient population right there.
Yep.
The sixth question, the patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors.
No. So, for example, 23% in the control group versus 11% in the Ultraplase group had a history of a stroke or a TIA, which is a very important prognostic factor. There was also a difference in lesion volume on DWI, which was larger in the Ultraplase group. And we know that an imbalance in baseline stroke severity or a past history of stroke seems to be a recurring theme in this literature and represents a threat to internal validity, along with other threats such as bias in the assessment of outcome and the simple possibility of chance.
Well, how about all participants, the patients, the clinicians, the outcome assessors? Were they unaware of group allocation?
No, only the outcome assessors.
And all groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention?
No. Antithrombotics were not given to the Ultraplase group for 25 hours.
How about the follow-up? Was it complete?
Yes.
All patient-important outcomes were considered?
Yes.
And the final question, the 11th question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
Well, let's go through the results. The original THAWS trial enrolled 131 patients. It was to have 300 patients, but was stopped early due to the results from the wake-up trial. The mean age was 74 years, 69% had hypertension, 35% had dyslipidemia, 37% atrial fibrillation, 20% were diabetic, and 17% had a history of ischemic stroke or TIA. What was the key result from this subgroup analysis?
So in their subgroup analysis, they said that some subgroups had better neurologic outcomes with TPA compared to the control group, while others did not.
And so their primary outcome was that good neurologic outcome defined as a modified Rankin scale score of 0 to 1 at 90 days. What did they find?
So they said for a DWI aspect score of 5 to 8, the relative risk was 4.75 with a very wide confidence interval, but they said this was a statistical difference.
Yeah, for wide, it went from 1.33 to 30.
Yeah, that's really wide.
And then when they looked at a subgroup of a DWI aspect score of 9 to 10, there was no statistical difference.
And with a core volume greater than 6.4 mils, again, no statistical difference with, again, not surprisingly, a very wide confidence interval from less than 1 to over 43.
Yeah, and with that dichotomization of core volume size of less than 6.4 mLs, there was no statistical difference. And actually, the confidence intervals were tight on those.
Yes.
Now, if we go back to the original THAWS trial, what was the key result from the THAWS trial?
They said there was no statistical difference in good neurologic outcome at 90 days.
So in the original trial, their primary outcome, there was no statistical difference. And then they did this subgroup analysis and teased out one subgroup that had a statistical difference. All right, for the primary outcome, that again, that was the good neurologic outcome at 90 days. What were the actual numbers?
So it was 47.1% TPA versus 48.3% for control, which was not a statistical difference, unsurprisingly.
And how about the secondary outcomes from the original THAWS trial?
All were statistically not significant except for recanalization of the culprit artery on MRA. They also reported intracranial hemorrhages as 26% TPA versus 14% control.
So almost double the amount of intracranial hemorrhage with TPA versus control or comparison group.
Yes, that's a recurring theme.
Well, they measured the aspect data, and I'll put some of the details in the show notes. Anything else you wanted to point out?
Look, only that it was a small subgroup of 47 patients that actually had an aspect score of 5 to 8. It is worth remembering that in the THORS trial, it was planned to have 300 patients and it was stopped early at 131. So this subgroup represents 37% of the cohort and only 16% of the population that they had originally determined a priori.
Yeah, and they did dichotomize patients with core volume with a cutoff level based on a receiver operator characteristic curve, or ROC, of 6.4 mLs. They observed some baseline differences between these two groups when they did that.
Yeah, patients with a core volume of greater than 6.4 mLs more commonly had atrial fibrillation, less commonly recognized symptoms at waking up, had a higher National Institutes of Health stroke severity score, and had a lower DWI aspects than those with a volume of less than 6.4 mils.
With this dichotomization based on core volume, what did they find with that?
They found that the percentage of favorable outcome was not different between TPA and the control groups. In patients with a volume greater than 6.4 mils, although not a statistical difference, a favorable outcome, they said, was more common in the TPA group than in the control group. Relative risk 6.15, but again, with a very wide confidence interval that crosses one. A change in that stroke severity score was larger in the control group for patients with a volume less than 6.4 mils. And the category shift in the modified Rankin scale score was larger in the TPA group for those with a volume greater than 6.4 mils.
Well, I think we've dived into the results section fairly thoroughly. So why don't we talk nerdy? And we've got 5 points to go through, and you've got the first one.
And Ken, I love talking nerdy with you.
I love talking nerdy with you too.
The first one is that they kept on saying in the paper that the wake-up study was positive. So they've always referred to this, and this is the paper by Tamala et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018. Now, that study stopped enrolling at 503 patients despite a target of 800. They reported a 90-day modified Rankin score of 0 to 1 of 53% TPA versus 42% placebo, with the median stroke severity score was 6 and a lesion volume of 2 mils. But deaths were 4.1% for TPA versus 1.2% for placebo. And they give a p-value of 0.07. Now, this is a clinically important difference, and it can be argued that the study was stopped before they could prove definitive harm. Also, the THORS study states that their design was similar to WakeUp, but there was no placebo arm in THORS. That's a massive difference. Also in THORS, they changed their eligibility criteria during the trial. So they went from a 12-hour time limit to no time limit to match the WakeUp trial. It is noteworthy that in the meta-analysis by Tamala on this subject, the authors promote a positive role for TPA in these patients, and they also state that there are more deaths with TPA, and that's in Tamala et al. Lancet 2020.
Yeah, it gets at the issue of, well, a few things. The issue of what's statistically important and what's clinically important, and I could argue that death is pretty clinically important. And the other idea is the absolute risk versus the relative risk. Can you imagine if the numbers were different and it went from 1.2% in the placebo group to 4.1%, but that was for benefit? I can imagine the ad saying 300%, more than 300% improvement. Of course, that would be relative, and the absolute number was 3%. And so it's nice to see absolute numbers with that, but I do share your concern about stopping trials early and what that could do to our interpretation.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
The second nerdy point I wanted to talk about was the dose of TPA. The dose of TPA was 0.6 milligrams per kilogram in the THAWS trial compared to the usual 0.9 milligrams per kilogram. Now, the authors state, quote, "The official dosage of Alteplase for stroke thrombolysis is 0.6 milligrams per kilogram in Japan, based on the results of a dose comparison trial using Dutaplase and the multi-center single-dose Japan Alteplase clinical trial. Concern for a risk of thrombolysis-associated intracranial hemorrhage in Asians was strong motivation for the trials of low-dose thrombolysis. Several Asian physicians also use Alteplase at 0.6 milligrams per kilogram from the perspective of ethnically similarity to Japanese, safety, and economy." End of quote.
One of the citations used is an open-label study of 0.6 milligrams per kilo Alteplase on 100 patients within 3 hours of symptom onset, with a power calculation based upon a 90% confidence interval. Anyway, the TPA dose in wake-up was 0.9 milligrams per kilo versus their 0.6 milligrams per kilo, another point of difference. Yet in THAWS, they state, the ENCHANTED study, ENCHANTED stands for Enhanced Control of Hypertension and Thrombolysis Stroke Study. So the ENCHANTED study revealed that the small difference of efficacy and overall similarity regarding the balance between efficacy and safety between 0.9 and 0.6 milligrams per kilo of Alteplase, though this trial did not reach its primary endpoint of non-inferiority.
And if you look back at the ENCHANTED conclusions, it was, quote, "This trial involving predominantly Asian patients with acute ischemic stroke did not show the non-inferiority of low-dose Alteplase to standard-dose Alteplase with respect to death and disability at 90 days. There were significant fewer symptomatic intracranial hemorrhages with the low-dose Alteplase." End of quote. Despite its statistical failure, the ENCHANTED trial demonstrates that reduced-dose TPA achieves similar clinical outcomes while decreasing death and intracranial hemorrhage.
I think they're trying to have it both ways.
Have their cake and eat it too?
Yep. All right, the third nerdy point, I've called it heterogeneity. I just want to remind everybody that there is so much heterogeneity in the stroke trials, both clinical heterogeneity and statistical heterogeneity. There are multiple different types of strokes and multiple different types of statistical analytic approaches. Remember that the reanalysis of the ECAS-3 trial in 2020 by ALPA found that we rarely consider the selective analysis reporting bias that can occur in the selection of methods for statistical analysis. So basically, people tend to use the analytic approach that gives them the answer they want to get.
The fourth nerdy point is about stopping early. There are problems with stopping studies early, and a good paper on this topic is by Guyette et al. In the BMJ 2012. This article highlights that studies stopped early for benefit overestimate benefits, especially if it's a small trial. Quote, "Uncritical belief in truncated trials will be misleading," end of quote. They advocate for a high level of skepticism on the findings of trials stopped early and bemoans how these studies are often published in high-profile journals with uncritical uptake by guideline panels and the media. Interestingly, Wallach et al. In JAMA Internal Medicine 2017 evaluated how often subgroup claims are corroborated by subsequent randomized control trials and meta-analyses. They concluded that, quote, "Attempts to corroborate statistical significant subgroup differences are rare, and when done, the initial observed subgroup differences are not reproduced. Yusuf et al. In JAMA 1991 states, quote, "The overall trial result is usually a better guide to the direction of effect in subgroups than the apparent effect observed within a subgroup," end of quote.
Yeah, that's a really important nerdy point, Ken. And now I get to the final one, which is conflicts of interest. There were multiple financial conflicts of interest in the Thor study, with many authors receiving payments from the manufacturer of Elteplase. This, again, is a recurring theme in the stroke literature, and industry-supported studies are associated with more favourable results and conclusions than sponsorship from other sources. And this has been well explained by Lund et al. In Cochrane 2012 and Hansen et al. In Cochrane 2019. The Institute of Medicine published guidelines on systematic reviews and meta-analyses and recommends the exclusion of, quote, "individuals with a clear financial conflict of interest," end of quote, and that's from Graham et al. In the National Academies Press 2011.
And I do like to make the point that conflicts of interest do not make the information presented incorrect, but it does make us more skeptical. All right, that's enough nerdiness. Let's comment on the author's conclusion and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
We would rewrite their conclusions to say that a subgroup analysis of the THORS data suggests that patients with a DWI aspects of 5 to 8 treated with low-dose thrombolysis compared to standard treatment may or may not have a more favorable outcome.
I see what you did there, putting the may or may not. Clearly, we were both taught by Dr. Jerry Hoffman.
Indeed.
All right, how about an SGEM bottom line?
This subgroup analysis of the THORS data is an interesting finding, but should be considered hypothesis generating and would need to be confirmed in a proper trial.
All right, well, Daniel, can you give us a case resolution? What are you going to do with that person that came in with the stroke symptoms that you had, plus the advanced neuroimaging that you described?
Well, the stroke service is called and the patient is admitted to the stroke unit under their care.
Yeah, and that's what would happen in my institution, is that we would call the stroke team or the stroke center and they would take the case from there. How about the clinical application?
I've said that the kindest interpretation of this subgroup analysis of a small, unblinded trial that was negative, that was stopped early, is that it is hypothesis generating. We know that the literature on replication of hypothesis generating subgroup analyses indicates that pursuit of this is unlikely, and if it is done, the results are rarely reproduced.
So what are you going to tell the patient at the bedside?
You've had a stroke and it was caused by a blockage to one of the blood vessels in the brain. All strokes are bad, but this one is at the milder end of the spectrum. We're going to call the stroke team, who will probably admit you to the stroke unit for therapy to help you get better.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And last week's winner was Dr. Cindy Bitter from Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Bitter is a repeat winner. She knew the main driver of hypoxia in flail chest is pulmonary contusion. What's the question this week, Daniel?
According to the study by Wallach in 2017, what percentage of statistical differences observed in subgroups were reproduced and confirmed?
And I'll give everybody a hint. It is a nice round number. And if you know what this round number is, then send an email to thesgem at gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. But if you are not the Keener contest winner, don't worry. You can also earn CME credits just for listening to this podcast. Yes, the content is always free, but there's a small fee for the CME. And this goes to help support this free, open access medical education project so patients can get the best care based on the best evidence. Thanks, Daniel, for coming back on and talking stroke.
It's been a lot of fun, Ken. I always enjoy doing this with you.
We might have to mix it up next time and do something not stroke related, if you're up to it.
I think I'll be up to it.
Oh, you're such a EM contrarian. Okay. All right, Daniel, can you read the tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.